Welcome to another special edition of Oncology Today, focused on the 2023 ASCO Annual Meeting, today discussing the management of hepatobiliary cancers. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. As a follow-up to a recent live CME symposium at the ASCO meeting, I met with Dr. Robin Katie Kelly from the University of California, San Francisco. To begin, I asked Dr. Kelly to comment on one of the most exciting developments in this field, the use of adjuvant systemic therapy.
So the IMbrave 050 trial looked at adjuvant atezolizumab plus bevacizumab for a full year, 12 months, in patients with HCC post-resection or ablation who had high-risk features, either a tumor greater than 5 centimeters or multiple tumors or poorly differentiated histology were some of the features that were considered high-risk and warranting eligibility. And I think around 90% of patients ended up getting surgery and only around 10% got ablation. And patients were randomized then to receive either 1 year of atezo-bev or just standard surveillance with the primary endpoint of recurrence-free survival. And at the first look at the data, the recurrence-free survival was significantly prolonged with the atezo-bev arm compared to placebo. But the data was quite immature with respect to overall survival, so we don't yet have any difference in survival to compare between the two arms, and the overall rate of events was quite low. And so I think the take-home message for me is that while it's encouraging to see this median recurrence-free survival be prolonged at this early look at the data, I don't know yet whether we're actually seeing a higher proportion of patients cured, because we don't know yet, are those patients going to still be recurrence-free at 2 years when they've been off the atezo-bev, or are we just treating micrometastatic disease early? So is this a durable effect of actual cure or just kicking the can down the road, so to speak? And secondly, I think it's really important to note, following upon that same point, are we really curing people? What's the long-term toxicity beyond just the safety window of the trial? Is this a safe regimen to give in the adjuvant setting, noting that probably at least 50% of patients will be cured as is?
I guess the other obvious issue here is this is not going to be a therapy that can be used in somebody who's had a transplant.
Right. We, at this time, after transplant in patients who have an allograft liver, we think that the risk of immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy causing fatal rejection exceeds its likelihood of any meaningful benefit.
Just out of curiosity, because I know there have been patients who've been transplanted who have gotten treated with IOs, what do we know about the rate of rejection?
There aren't, as you can imagine, there's not a ton of data across several series of, you know, between 10 and 30 patients roughly in each series. We see that rates of rejection, and for liver transplant, that often is fatal rejection, are tend to be 30% or higher, or, you know, at least 20% and probably 30% across these studies, some higher than that.
And a question that really is going to apply to a lot of things we're going to talk about today, but in general, in terms of checkpoint inhibitors and HCC, I haven't heard very much that sounds encouraging in terms of predicting benefit, PD-1, TMB, anything out there that's helpful.
I'd say not yet. There's data from IMbrave 150 analyses of biomarker data presented by Andrew Zhu in Nature Genetics, I believe, 2022, which showed that maybe patients with TERT mutations potentially had slightly more favorable outcomes and patients with beta-catenin had better outcomes on sorafenib, but neither qualified as a strong predictive biomarker. And interestingly, TMB and microsatellite instability status have not been a strong predictor, both in the IMbrave 150 as well as the CheckMate 459 analyses.
That's so true in so many cancers nowadays. One other thing, again, just sort of a general thing that I'll bring up right now, but it has relevance in general, which is the issue of viral versus non-viral etiology of the HCC and benefit from checkpoint inhibitors.
We've been very interested in this question for a while. And back in 2021, a meta-analysis was presented, led by Pfister et al. In Nature, showing that patients with viral etiologies, particularly hepatitis B, combined from the CheckMate 459 trial, IMbrave 150, and KEYNOTE 240, had favorable overall survival outcomes compared to non-viral patients who did not seem to differentiate between the control arm, either placebo or no treatment or sorafenib, and depending whether it was the first line or second line context. Now, interestingly, though, if you look at those, the phase two trials leading up to those phase threes, as well as the response rates in the phase threes, this overall survival phenomenon is really not consistently borne out in the more direct efficacy data, meaning the response rates and the PFSs don't really differentiate by viral status. And so that begs the question of, are we really seeing a post-progression phenomenon based on the comorbidities that track with non-viral or the access to other downstream therapies that track with Western or Eastern parts of the world? And so it's a much more complicated clinical question with lots of confounders than just response.
The other thing, and I imagine this must change depending on where you are geographically, and be curious to know kind of what the typical mix is. And I'm just kind of curious in terms of the patients that you're seeing, of course, a lot of them are referred as well. What's the non-viral phenotype that you see? Are these obese patients, or, you know, you really can't pin that down? Do they have NASH?
So unfortunately, NASH is very underdiagnosed, and we, you know, often will surmise that patients might have had some non-alcoholic fatty liver disease or NAFLD, and maybe NASH based on looking back 5 years ago, they had some transaminitis that was on and off. You know, every lab draw, they had an ALT that was a little high or fluctuated. So we can make guesses, but often patients that have a confirmed diagnosis of NAFLD or NASH will be diabetic and have been getting labs checked for other reasons and then get captured. And then, you know, often people who are in a good health system will get referred to hepatology clinics these days. But what we see in our clinic, as you allude to, a lot of them come in and we have, they may be non-viral, but they've never been formally evaluated for NASH. And we have to just make assumptions based on obesity, diabetes, hyperlipidemia, family history.
So I want to mention a question that came from one of the docs in our survey, quote, I have a 76-year-old man who just had HCC resection, stage one, but vascular invasion. Anything we can do to reduce the risk of recurrence, the doc says. What is the role of ctDNA to predict recurrence? So first of all, just based on what you heard, what would you estimate the risk of recurrence is in this patient? What in general is the recurrence rate in general of people who end up going to surgery? And any thoughts about this case and also the ctDNA question?
Great question. So I think generally, after surgery for patients with higher risk features, we worry that maybe the risk of recurrence may approach or exceed even 50% at 5 years, depending upon the nature of the vascular invasion and what the risk factors are. AFP can play a role. So for a patient with I don't know if it was microvessel invasion or frank macrovessel invasion and what the differentiation was and what the AFP pre and post was, but macrovessel invasion, we think the recurrence rate is extremely high, much greater than 50%, particularly also patients who don't clear their AFP and have a persistently high AFP value that never goes away. We think those are extremely high risk of recurrence. So in a patient who has, you know, now tiny microvessel invasion is a more sticky prognostic factor, but also does increase the risk of recurrence significantly and to the point that we really worry about those patients we see in post-transplant. So to the clinician's question, you know, this is a patient where if it's macrovessel invasion, high AFP, poorly differentiated, that's a patient who would have been eligible for the IMBRAVE 050 adjuvant trial. And while we discussed earlier that the data are not mature yet with respect to the OS and we have longer follow-up is needed to know if we're really curing patients versus delaying recurrence, I think this is a patient, if they have macrovessel invasion and high-risk features, it's worth discussing with them the results, the knowns and the unknowns, and offering atezo-bev in the adjuvant setting.
I guess you could say even if you know that the patient's going to recur, that the patient doesn't have any symptoms or evidence of disease, I guess it'd be hard to know whether or not treating early would be better. What about this question about the ctDNA?
I believe that ctDNA probably can predict recurrence earlier, but back to your point, until we have knowledge of whether somebody's going to have a greater chance of being cured or have a greater chance of a more durable response by switching systemic therapies in the advanced setting, I don't know that we have data to show that we're helping patients by doing that earlier yet. So I have not been using it in HCC.
Just out of curiosity, are there tumor-informed assays, a Signatera? Can you send that in HCC? And are there any situations in HCC where you might want to use it? clinically, not necessarily in the adjuvant setting, maybe oligometastatic or something, any situations where you might want to use it?
So Signatera has done some research showing that you can detect recurrence early. And so I think that, again, if we had really strong adjuvant data, that would, you know, more mature data from IMbrave 050, that would potentially be worthwhile if we can increase our chance of cure. But again, we need the data. I think the role for other cell-free DNA biomarker testing makes more sense in patients where I'm not confident of the histology. So it might be a mixed HCC cholangio, has features that are suspicious for some hidden cholangio in there. Or if it's been a resected patient, a patient with mixed tumor histology suggesting that there's a component of cholangiocarcinoma, then I will also check ctDNA, particularly and specifically in advanced patients where we might need the therapy predictive biomarker testing done.
So I don't have to tell you what the number two question was in HCC, which is what's the optimal first line therapy? But before we even get to that, there were a lot of questions about the issue of choosing between liver-directed therapy and systemic therapy. And when I first saw the atezo-bev data, my first thought was, I wonder if there's going to be less, you know, local therapy to liver. Oncologists are always telling me they get these patients when they've had really extensive treatment. So first question is, have you seen a shift away from local therapy since these regimens have come in practice? In your own practice, you find yourself turning to systemic therapy more frequently?
Yes, we have. And it's particularly for those patients where we've always known that liver-directed therapy isn't great, but we've been at a loss given the lack of great options. But the example would be patients with very infiltrative, heterogeneous tumors that aren't consistently enhancing. We know that arterial therapies don't do well without robust enhancement. Patients with multifocal disease, bilobar disease, where we know that it's clearly not going to be a curative therapy, and patients with borderline liver function where they may have just one shot on goal in terms of a liver-directed treatment compromising their liver function. Those patients were shifting to systemic therapy much earlier now.
One of the specific questions here I see is, would you give systemic therapy to a patient with diffuse involvement of the liver but no extrahepatic disease?
Yes, absolutely. Especially diffuse infiltrative picture, those patients don't do well. You have to treat a huge amount of the liver to treat all of the tumor. And even then, you don't know quite where it is. And they're at higher risk for decompensation if you're treating large amounts of healthy liver or remnant liver.
I just noticed the question right underneath that one that's kind of interesting that I hear intermittently in different cancers, which is, do antibodies to atezolizumab impact the benefit of treatment? How do you measure them? How reliable are they? What do we know about antibodies to PD-1 in general? And I think it seems like I've heard more about atezo, but what do we know about that?
So atezolizumab, using the assay used in the clinical trials for atezolizumab, does have a higher rate of anti-drug antibody formation. So patients start atezolizumab, are naive to it, don't have any baseline antibodies, but develop it on the course of treatment. And I think from IMbrave 150, the rate was around 20%. And patients who develop those antibodies tended to have worse survival outcomes. However, the caveat here is that not all of those antibodies are the same, and some of them may be truly neutralizing, which could explain a worse outcome. Others may be just a sign of a robust immune response and maybe actually demonstrating some immune activity. And we don't know, so the antibodies themselves are not homogeneous, and the assay is not something available clinically for prime time because of this. It's purely a research tool. And so while it gives me pause to worry that my patient may not be responding to atezo because maybe they did develop a neutralizing antibody, the antibody existence itself does not prove that it's a bad antibody, and we don't have a test for it. Now, I think clinically, though, it does give me reason to think that, you know, if I do have an early progressor on atezo who's otherwise fit, I may try a different PD-1 inhibitor downstream under the possibility that they had a neutralizing antibody to atezo.
So speaking of other antibodies, of course, people want to know about durva-tremi versus atezo-bev. And another question I see right underneath a bunch of these is, what's the best regimen that'll provide a rapid response in a patient with severe pain, multiple bone mets, a biopsy proven? So in general, how do you decide between the two therapies? And what about the patient who needs a response quickly?
So they both tend to in the patients who achieve radiographic response, both regimens do have a relatively quick rate of response, usually within 2 cycles or so. Now, I think right now, there again are no head-to-head comparisons with respect to response rate and PFS and OS for the two studies, but comparing between trials and all the intended caveats thereof, I think it's fair to say that the atezo-bev regimen does have a higher progression-free survival rate, disease control rate than durvalumab. While durvalumab, we do see that those patients who did get a response have an extremely long response, and we don't yet have the, say, 3-year and 4-year data from atezo-bev like we do from durvalumab. So in the patient described who has kind of urgent tumor burden needing at least disease control or response, presuming no contraindications or comorbidities that drive me otherwise, I would probably pick atezo-bev because of that higher PFS, the higher disease control rate. Again, assuming no comorbidities that drive me to durvalumab instead.
And what about the, you know, more typical patient? How do you decide between the two? In particular, you know, atezo-bev came out first. People are used to it, and that's always a big advantage. But are there patients specifically, you know, of course, you have the issue of Bev and potential contraindications there. So how do you sort of decide between the two, and in what situations are you using the Himalaya regimen?
So I make decisions in part based on comorbidity profile. You mentioned earlier the vascular disease or the NAFLD or NASH patients that are really hard to recognize. But those patients, that population, which is growing in all of our clinics, often has diabetes, often has peripheral artery disease or cardiovascular disease. I had a recent patient come in who had a history of TIA and stroke on a blood thinner and had some claudication when he walked. And while there were no frank contraindications to atezo-bev, I chose the STRIDE regimen because patients on IMBRAVE 150 weren't allowed to be anticoagulated, and I worry a lot about peripheral vascular disease and other risk of blood clot and bleeding. So in those patients who have a lot of cardiovascular risk factors or actual disease, I favor STRIDE, all else being equal. And I think it's important to, you know, one of the huge advantages in the clinic for STRIDE is that while when you have someone on atezo-bev, you have to worry about the dental extraction and the blood pressure management and the incidental surgery management of Bev for the entire time that they're on. For durvalumab, you get the single dose tremi at the very beginning and just the one time dose. And we saw from ASCO data on immune related adverse events, ASCO 2023, that the majority of serious immune related adverse events occur in those first 3 months. And in patients who have a response and end up on durva monotherapy thereafter, it's pretty smooth sailing without a lot of intervention on the part of the oncologist. Of course, immune-related adverse events can occur anytime, but the majority of them are in those first 3 months, and there's not a lot of care required, such as, you know, managing an anti-angiogenic long-term.
Any suggestion of course, this comes up anytime we talk about checkpoint inhibitors, correlation between autoimmune toxicity and treatment benefit?
So yes, I think all of us have seen some of the data in melanoma and renal cell, the earliest checkpoint inhibitor success stories where patients with neuropathy are more likely to have a response and things like that. In HCC, the STRIDE regimen from Himalaya presented such data at ASCO this year. Dr. Yao presented it. And we saw that patients who had an immune-mediated adverse event had a significantly longer median overall survival and also had a higher response rate. And so while the overall population clearly benefited and patients without an immune-mediated adverse event also had favorable outcomes compared to sorafenib, those who had an immune-mediated adverse event had the best outcomes numerically.
We did a satellite at ASCO, and in the lung cancer meeting, they were talking about this, and they brought up the issue of specifically dermatologic toxicity and benefit. Do you see that also with HCC?
I don't know that that analysis has been done. I have seen several, I have a handful, a small mini collection of my own patients who have had nodular skin toxicity, the actinic keratoses on immune checkpoint inhibitors who have gone on to have complete responses, which is quite bizarre. But that's, again, a very small anecdotal experience.
So the other issue I wanted to ask you about is when people see the STRIDE regimen, one of the things they think about is ipi-nivo, which of course a lot of people do have experience with melanoma and otherwise, and where of course you do see a lot of autoimmune toxicity, a lot of use of corticosteroids. How would you indirectly compare autoimmune toxicity with STRIDE versus ipi-nivo?
I personally am advocating for including systemic steroid requirement rate as an endpoint in immune checkpoint inhibitor trials, particularly combinations, because it is incredibly meaningful to patients and the providers, and the impact on toxicity is big to be on prednisone of 40 milligrams or higher for a month. So comparing that metric, when we looked at the CheckMate 040 trial as the most mature data to date on ipi-nivo in HCC, and the most effective regimen selected to move forward into the phase 3 trial, which is still ongoing, called CheckMate 90W, the regimen used for 90W was ipi-3-nivo-1. So ipi 3 milligrams per kilogram given four times, plus nivolumab 1 milligram per kilogram given continuously, or then transitioned after the first four doses to continuous nivo alone. With the nivo 1 ipi 3 high dose ipi regimen, the steroid requirement rate was 50%, presented by Anthony El-Khoury at ILCA. It hasn't been published, but it was presented publicly in 2019. And so that is about what we expect from melanoma and renal cell data of the IPI-3-NIVO-1 regimen. Conversely, if you look at the STRIDE regimen with the single dose tremelimumab, the steroid requirement rate in the study 22 large phase 2 trial preceding Himalaya and Himalaya itself was about 20%. So definitely lower, about half as lower, a little more than half lower.
So the final question about HCC relates to TKIs and a lot of questions about which comes first. Your experience with TKIs. So can you just generally comment? First, we could even start first line in patients through contraindications to IO, but particularly second line and beyond.
Right. So again, there are patients with contraindications to IO prior transplant, as we talked about, or significant autoimmune disease where we worry about pretty high risk of flare or worsening. In those patients, I do use lenvatinib first line still, and the majority occasionally sorafenib if there's very poor liver function or Child-Pugh B or worse liver function. And occasionally a patient with very minimal metastatic disease who lives far away and doesn't want to come to the infusion center every 3 weeks or every 4 weeks. And so occasionally there will be a patient where we start with lenvatinib for other reasons, patient preference, with indolent low disease burden would be the example. Now in the second line, which is again the predominant use of TKIs these days in HCC, the big split is whether to use a drug, a formerly first-line drug like lenvatinib or sorafenib reflexively as the new second line and then follow suit sequentially versus use something like cabozantinib, which has more flexible real-world data in its the design of the Celestial trial, which did have a first, a second and third line design and allowed for more than just sorafenib prior to entry. So for that reason, you know, cabozantinib has appeal. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I do make choices based on comorbidity profile and what the toxicities were on first-line therapy to choose between usually lenvatinib or cabozantinib based on their efficacy. Lenvatinib had quite impressive efficacy as monotherapy, as we all know from LiPo2. And cabozantinib also showed impressive monotherapy efficacy in COSMIC 312 in the first line. And we know both of them from post hoc analyses, we know that both of them have good efficacy post atezo-bev in at least a small series of patients. So I'll pick lenvatinib in patients who didn't have significant hypertension or proteinuria after atezo-bev, for example. I'll pick cabozantinib in a patient who had a lot of problems with hypertension or proteinuria, which are more difficult to manage with lenvatinib.
So actually quite a few questions about dosing of TKIs, particularly cabo and lenvatinib. How do you approach it?
So cabo's label recommends using a dose of 40 milligrams for patients with Child-Pugh B liver function, instead of the standard dose of 60 milligrams in second or third line. So I'll use 40 milligrams for patients who have Child-Pugh B or borderline Child-Pugh B liver function and I'm worried about their liver function. I often also will extrapolate from that and use 40 milligrams starting dose in more fragile patients with other comorbidities, and then escalate up if they do great, if they have no toxicity, or go down to 20 milligrams if they have significant diarrhea or hand-foot syndrome. For lenvatinib, the starting dose in HCC is 12 milligrams for patients that are 60 kilograms or more in weight, but patients who are flirting with 60 or less weight or who have borderline liver function, I'll start with the 8 milligram dose.
So let's talk a little bit about biliary tract cancers. And again, I think one of the most common questions we got is about first-line therapy. We have the TOPAZ approach of durvalumab plus chemo. We have the KEYNOTE 966 trial of pembro with chemo. Again, kind of putting aside access issues, but sort of from a clinical perspective, how would you compare those two options? And I'll just throw in, of course, the most common question we heard all through ASCO, which is, what do you do about the chemo shortage?
Yeah, great questions. So beginning with the first question, I think both Topaz 1 and Keynote 966 really reinforce and cross-validate each other in showing that there is benefit to adding an immune checkpoint inhibitor to GemCis in the first-line context in all-comer biliary tract cancers, and that this benefit persists whether one continues gemcitabine more than 6 months versus whether one stops cold turkey all chemo after 6 months. And so I think that was what was very important about 966 in addition to Topaz 1, and that 966 allowed patients to continue gemcitabine according to investigator and patient preference and how the patient was doing at that 6 month mark, which is what we do in practice. And so one of the questions that arose from Topaz is, are we seeing this separation of the curves at 6 months because you just stopped all the chemo? And of course, patients who are dependent on chemo are going to progress at that point, and that may accentuate the benefit perceived. And conversely, you still see that benefit maintained even when continuing the GEM in 966. So again, they validate each other that there's a role for adding the immune checkpoint inhibitor in this first line context. I don't think we have any data to tell us which one's better. I think they both had very similar outcomes, bearing in mind cross-trial differences. One was centrally reviewed imaging, one was not. Keynote 966 was centrally reviewed, Topaz 1 was investigator, and they have slightly different populations, but overall, both strongly support the strategy. In terms of the shortage, I believe was the next part of your question. This is we still are fortunate to be able to get cisplatin for our first line patients right now at my institution, but we have strategies for rationing. And I think, one of the important points as an advocate for our biliary tract cancer patients is that we only use 25 milligrams per meter squared, and it is a much lower dose. And so we can treat, three patients with biliary tract cancers, compared to one with many other indications, because that's, two out of 3 week dosing. So that's one point in favor of using it. I think, though, that in the era of shortage, it suggests that perhaps we could use it. My strategy has been, instead of continuing it for 6 months, maybe stop at 4 months in a patient who's having early toxicity, or plan to add it later in a patient that we just can't get it in the, say, community site. Start with GEM and durvalumab and then add the cisplatin once the cisplatin becomes available.
It's hard to believe we're actually having this conversation, huh?
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's like not believable. Anyhow, interestingly, one of the questions came in, I guess somebody had a patient with biliary tract cancer who had a high TMB. Do you approach those patients any differently in terms of your choice of therapy? This doc, I don't know, it doesn't say how high the TMB was, but brings up what you think about ipi/nivo.
So I have had a pretty decent collection of patients now who have microsatellite instability and, of course, high TMB with biliary tract cancers. And unlike HCC, microsatellite instability does predict for response to immune checkpoint inhibitors. And cholangiocarcinoma patients were in Pembro data leading to tumor agnostic approvals. Cholangio comprised a subset of all of those impressive complete responses on those waterfall plots. And so I think the question is, if you have an MSI high patient with cholangio, do you need the chemo? Might they have a complete response with the Pembro alone? And so that's the discussion I would have in a patient who perhaps has a low burden of disease and is not imminently at threat from their tumor burden. I might start with Pembro monotherapy. I have seen and have patients with prolonged complete responses, and dare I say, even patients who have had complete responses in metastatic disease and are now off treatment from monotherapy.
So I want to move on and talk about targeted therapy in biliary tract cancers, but just one other question in terms of how people in general manage biliary tract cancers, and the fact that I'm using that term, I think also brings up the issue of how do you differentiate between them? I mean, people like you, when I sit down and talk to you, have all these things in your mind about if it's a cholangio or intrahepatic, extrahepatic. But for the general medical oncologist and community-based practice who's trying to keep track of everything, are there any sort of myths or misperceptions about this whole issue or things that people really ought to be aware of in terms of approaching people differently based on the where the biliary tract cancer starts?
So I think right now our first line data, while sometimes in a couple subgroup analyses, we've seen worse outcomes with the extrahepatic and perihilar and distal than intrahepatic. I think one of the things that's important to remember is the advanced extrahepatics, where they're right at the tumor hilum, like the so-called old-fashioned name Klatskin tumor, versus the ones that are closer to the head of the pancreas, the distals. Those are really difficult patients that often have obstruction and complicated stent and drainage issues. And so their outcomes are harder to interpret on clinical trials due to the complications of infection and blockage. And that said, I think as a whole, the data from KEYNOTE-966 and TOPAZ-1 reassure us that overall, all anatomic subsites seem to benefit from GemCis and immune checkpoint inhibitor, with the caveats that there's more complications in some sites than others. Intrahepatics always seem to perform best, probably because they have fewer such complications, is my interpretation of these data. But as a whole, right now, we think that they behave similarly with this sort of all-comer approach. Now, where things get different is in second line, because intrahepatic definitely have a distinct pattern of targetable aberrations compared to extrahepatic and gallbladder. So we see the FGFR2 fusions, we see the IDH1 mutations nearly exclusively in intrahepatic, where extrahepatic and gallbladder tend to have higher rates of HER2 amplification or overexpression. Other aberrations are probably pretty similar. BRAF is probably similar across these, at least intra and extrahepatic. We don't know as much about gallbladder. But point being, it's very important to get tumor next generation sequencing with a good panel and consider even repeating it or doing cell-free DNA if you have insufficient quantity for your intrahepatics. For extrahepatics and gallbladders, HER2 immunohistochemistry is more important to obtain, even though it can still be overexpressed in intrahepatic as well. But when we get into the targeted therapy realm, that's when the anatomic subsite can bias what we're likely to find.
And then again, before we get to targeted therapy, what about the entity I've heard about of like mixed HCC and biliary tract cancer, where you can't tell which one it is? How often do you see it and how do you treat those patients?
So maybe potentially up to like 5 to 10% of HCCs if one does a national audit of tumor samples, as was done in the UK a few years back, of those that are called HCC clinically end up being a mixed HCC cholangio. They arise in the setting of liver injury like hepatitis C, even fatty liver alcohol, just like a HCC does. So the etiologies are quite similar. Sometimes you can get a clue to this based on radiographic features or mixed tumor marker elevation, but biopsy is the best tool. And even within mixed HCC cholangio, there's some heterogeneity. There are some that are an HCC tumor and a cholangio tumor right next to each other because it's a field effect, and in which case you have two primaries really. And then there are other tumors where the cells are all pretty homogenous, but they share markers of both, where they have expression of both HCC and cholangio markers, and they're more immature type cells. And right now we don't have prospective data to tell us how to treat them. I think the TOPAZ-1 regimen is actually a logical place to start because durvalumab has activity in HCC, we know from Himalaya. And GemCis Durva has activity in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. So that's been my current practice for advanced mixed HCC cholangio.
Makes a lot of sense. You know, I was just sort of flashing on the fact that we're going to put this program out on audio. I love hearing stories about what they're doing. The most recent one I heard was raking the leaves. I thought that was kind of cool. But anyhow, for those people who aren't watching, can you talk about sort of the artwork behind you? You were telling me about that before.
Behind me, I have a structure, a metal artwork that is some branching structures of trees with leaves on them. And one of my longstanding patients, who's now almost more of a friend than a patient, I've been taking care of her for metastatic cholangiocarcinoma for, gosh, over 6 years now. And she's having a complete response on immunotherapy. She found this piece of artwork at a garage sale. And it reminded her of the picture I showed her way back when she first came in, of the bile ducts, which I always say they branch like a tree. And the intrahepatic bile ducts are like little tiny leaves on the tree. And then you have the main ducts leading to the common bile duct, which is the trunk. And so that's why I have this artwork on my wall.
All right. Go back to raking your leaves. All right. Let's talk about targeted therapy. First, FGFR, I'm going to say abnormalities, because recently I'm getting a little, you know, I hear about this in bladder also and others, confused between fusions and mutations. So can you, first of all, just talk about what we know about FGFR alterations and then what we know about the various inhibitors that are being studied?
Sure.
And in practice.
So FGFR, there's a family of FGFR genes, FGFR 1, 2, 3, and 4, the most common. And they are oncogenes in that when they are out of normal control, they cause proliferation, angiogenesis, metastasis, invasion, all the things that cancer genes do. FGFR2 in particular has a predilection for being altered in biliary tract cancers, among several other rare tumor types. As you mentioned, urothelial is another one. And it can be, the gene FGFR2 can be altered and overactivated in a variety of ways. In cholangiocarcinoma, about 10% of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas within the liver will have what's called a fusion or a rearrangement, where a non-coding, so not the actual protein itself, but a non-coding regulatory part of the gene is connected to some other gene. And the way I think of it in a simplistic way is you connect the business part of the gene, which is normally tightly regulated because it's an important oncogene. You would connect it to something that's more of a housekeeping gene that's not tightly regulated or that's overly active because it's a boring gene, and instead you turn it on excessively. And so if you take the normal part of FGFR2 and put it under a different control mechanism, it will be overactivated and make way too much FGFR2, causing invasion, metastasis, cancer. That's a fusion or a rearrangement. They're subtle. If you know which gene it's connected to, we call it a fusion. If it's rearranged to a different place that's not fully understood, it's a rearrangement. Both of those, though, cause too much of the normal protein to be made and functioning. Now, mutations in the kinase domain, so actual mutations in the business part of the protein, can also make the gene out of control from a regulation standpoint, because the normal molecular brake that turns the gene on and off when it should be will be displaced, or the ATP binding pocket will be shifted in a way that makes it more active than usual. So there can be activating mutations, or a cell can just acquire too many copies of the coding part and make just too much of the protein and be amplified. So those are sort of the three ways that FGFR2 in particular can become oncogenic and drive a cholangiocarcinoma. Now, the fusions and rearrangements are the first ones that we've honed in on as being susceptible to inhibition therapeutically. And so drugs like pemigatinib and infigratinib were the ATP competitive inhibitors that would bind to the ATP pocket of FGFR2, turn off its signaling, and cause a tumor shrinkage and prolonged progression-free survival. There are next generations FGFR2 inhibitors that work in different ways and bind in different locations, covalently, such as futibatinib, and also covalently, but in an FGFR2 selective way, such as RLY-4008, which are also inhibitory both to the fusions and rearrangements, but also potentially, at least for RLY-4008, potentially for mutations and maybe amplifications, though that data is still out.
And any difference in response to the various inhibitors, whether it's a mutation or a fusion?
So for pemigatinib, the really successful responses were really in the fusions and rearrangements and not so much in other alterations. And though we see some mutations and fusions being responsive, mutations and other alterations being responsive to the covalent inhibitor futibatinib and also to RLY-4008. So the mechanism of the inhibitor does matter.
Can you talk a little bit about, you've mentioned pemigatinib, about the various FGFR inhibitors that are either available now or being studied and look optimistic, and what the difference is between them? You see significant differences.
So pemigatinib and infigratinib were ATP competitive inhibitors. Infigratinib is no longer being manufactured for cholangiocarcinoma, probably because of the competitive landscape, and is more, I would think of it more as a me too, because it's also an ATP competitive. So pemigatinib was approved first, has a very nice response rate around 40% and prolonged progression-free survival in the fusion rearrangement population. But over time on the ATP competitive inhibitors in particular, Lipika Goyal and the Harvard group have shown that kinase domain, the business part of the protein, mutations arise that lead to resistance to the ATP competitive inhibitors. And those resistance mutations either kick the drug out of the ATP binding pocket or change the conformation of the protein in a way that it no longer responds. And so that limits the duration of effectiveness of these inhibitors. The newer inhibitors such as futibatinib also can develop resistance over time, but can inhibit some of those resistance mutations themselves, looking at preclinical models of those actual mutations that occur in the kinase domain in addition to the original parental fusion. So futibatinib works against some of the resistance mutations, and as it was published in New England Journal, they have a nice plot of which mutations it has activity against in addition to the wild type caused by that is overactivated by the fusion. And the next generation is, I would say, RLY-4008, which is an FGFR2 selective, very potent for FGFR2, but without the FGFR1 and 3 activity that removes some of the downstream side effects and allow it to be more potent on FGFR2.
also hit some of those resistance mechanisms and so far has the highest presented response rate as the FGFR2 selective potent inhibitor.
So I don't know if there are trials. It wouldn't surprise me that there would be trials with FGFR inhibitors versus chemo IO. I'm curious, if there were a trial like that, what do you think it would show?
So those trials have had a very difficult time accruing because of the rarity of the population. Again, we're talking about 10% of a rare cancer, 10% of the intrahepatic component of a rare cancer. So I think the first line trials have, some of them have actually shut down due to low accrual and very difficult conditions numbers wise. I think it's hard to know how they would compare head to head because we don't yet have complete data on the progression-free survival for FGFR2 fusions with Gemcitabine Durva, say in TOPAZ-1, because of this very small sample size. We don't know how that unique molecular subset performs.
Yeah, you know, I always joke around that biliary tract cancers is the new non-small cell. And there with lung cancer, you know, they did one study of chemo versus EGFR, you know, gefitinib, and the people did better with gefitinib. And I think they did stuff like that with ALK. And then they stopped doing randomized studies. They found something that caused a 50% response rate. They just start using it first line. I don't know if that's ever going to happen with you all.
I think it's very plausible. The Relay 4008 drug is reporting much higher response rates than 50%, up to 80-some percent in the cohort presented at ESMO 2022 by Hollebeck et al. We'll see if that bears out in the pivotal cohort that's ongoing, which will be a much larger cohort, but it's quite exciting data. And I think the other piece, analogous to what you mentioned in lung cancer, is we now have several agents that are designed specifically for those resistance mutations to follow upon these first generation or even advanced first generation drugs. So there will be a pipeline of drugs specifically for FGFR and FGFR resistance.
So let me read you a couple more questions from oncologists. Quote, I'm treating a patient with cholangiocarcinoma with pemigatinib. This individual developed hyperphosphatemia and nail toxicity. Would you be able to provide, quote, pearls for someone who doesn't use the drug very often? My guess is probably the only time that docs ever use pemigatinib. Any pearls?
Yes. So the FGFR 1 through 3 inhibitors like pemigatinib, infigratinib, and futibatinib that have FGFR 1 activity as well as FGFR 2 cause hyperphosphatemia in most patients, upwards of 70% and higher in my experience. And so we monitor phosphorus, and as soon as it looks high, 5.5 or higher is the number that a lot of the clinical trials use, we add a phos binder such as Sevelamer, which is used in chronic kidney disease to bind high phosphorus levels. And it's a bit of a horse pill and kind of unfavorable for patients to take, but they need to take it 3 times a day with meals. A low phosphorus diet might help, but I think the binder is needed. And you want to keep the phosphorus in the grade 1 or, you know, 5.5 range. There is a theoretic potential for ectopic calcification if the phosphorus is too high. And so that's the issue with the FGFR, pan-FGFR inhibitors such as pemigatinib, futibatinib. Relay 4008 just hits FGFR2, does not have much FGFR1, so it does not show much hyperphosphatemia, thankfully. Now, the nail toxicity is an FGFR2 phenomenon, and all patients seem to get it, and it is bothersome. People will get progressive onychodystrophy, so thickening, cracking, sometimes fungal infections in these compromised nails, sometimes paronychia, and eventually onycholysis, meaning complete nail loss, where people will lose their nails. Now, once people get to complete onycholysis, it's usually more tolerable. It's not so visually discomfiting, and it's more comfortable because nails aren't pulling off once they're off. But people need to use topical antimicrobials, vinegar and water soaks. It's kind of a pretty full-time job to take care of one's nails when they're in the onychodystrophy phase. But a couple times a day, vinegar soaks, application of the antimicrobial ointment to any cracked or red areas. And then sometimes we'll use topical steroid to any inflamed areas and then coat it with a urea cream and Vaseline to cracked areas.
Yeah, it does not sound like fun. So I guess you could also say that biliary tract cancer sort of is another new AML in terms of IDH inhibitors. I'm trying to get ready for a big webinar next week on high-risk MDS. They're using IDH inhibitors also. So what do we know about IDH mutations in biliary tract cancers and IDH inhibitors?
So IDH1 mutations occur probably in about 15% also of intrahepatic. And the IDH1 inhibitor, ivosidenib, inhibits that mutant IDH1 protein. And Interestingly, IDH1 mutations in cholangiocarcinoma cause a loss of differentiation. And so we see a proliferation of poorly differentiated immature cells in the tumor. And blocking the mutant metabolite, oncometabolite 2-hydroxyglutarate, results in differentiation. So the tumors don't shrink so much as the cells, if thoroughly biopsied, show more of a cholangiocyte phenotype as opposed to an immature phenotype. So they mature and stop growing so fast, not shrinking so much. So as you might expect, the response rate to an IDH1 inhibitor such as ivosidenib tends to be low, less than 5%. But we see a prolongation in progression-free survival in a subset of patients. Usually the results are modest by just a month or two in the big phase 3 trial called Clarity. But we do have like any targeted inhibitor, we see a tail of the curve with subset of patients having prolonged responses or prolonged stabilization. I think our longest patient is in the 3+ year range of progression-free survival.
And of course, in AML and MDS, or mainly AML, you have the issue of differentiation syndrome. Do you see that with biliary tract cancers?
No. Being a focused tumor in the liver, a solid tumor not in circulation, and also not having such an exuberant response rate of actually killing the cells, but there's not a differentiation syndrome that's associated with the hematologic cells. Also, the cholangiocytes don't release that same profile of inflammatory cytokines or mediators.
So last topic is HER2 alterations in biliary tract cancer, overexpression and mutations. I'd like to know how often you see that. And particularly, what are some of the new and exciting approaches to this? Some of the things that we talked about in the meeting at ASCO, of course, trastuzumab deruxtecan, we talk about it every time we hear about HER2. But also tucatinib, which is a TKI that's used a lot in breast cancer as part of the HER-CLIMB regimen. And then another agent I had not heard about before, zanidatamab. So can you talk about, first of all, HER2 alterations, what you see in biliary tract, and some of these new and exciting approaches?
Sure. So we don't have great data on exactly what the incidences are, but we know that the frequency of HER2 overexpression is greatest in gallbladder, probably at least 20%. In the gallbladder context, probably at least 10% in extrahepatic and probably at least 5% in intrahepatic, bearing in mind that we don't have great cohorts of tumor tissue with consistent HER2 testing. Mutations can also happen in these three locations, but are less common than the overexpression rates. So mutations are much less than that, probably in the 5% range. And so looking at some of the earliest data, we think these are a valid target based on, one, there was the MyPathway trial looking at pertuzumab plus trastuzumab in a 39-patient biliary tract cancer cohort that showed, and these were refractory patients who had lots of prior therapies, it showed a response rate of around 23% that was pretty durable. So that was encouraging. You mentioned the trastuzumab deruxtecan agent, and the HERB trial was presented at ASCO 2022 and showed a response rate of 36% in the HER2 positive 2+ or 3+ population and 12.5% in the HER2 low population. So again, another signal. And this year at ASCO, as you mentioned, we had results from two different agents. The first you mentioned is zanidatamab, and it is a bispecific antibody which simultaneously binds two different HER2 molecules in trans. So it links two different HER2 proteins when overexpressed. And in this basket trial that included a biliary cohort, patients with either HER2 2+ or HER2 3+ by IHC were enrolled in one of the cohorts. Majority of those patients happened to be 3+. So almost 80% of them were 3+. So bear in mind, the data probably reflect the 3+ population most. But again, the signal response was quite impressive with an objective response rate by central review of 41% and a disease control rate of almost 70%. The majority of these were pretty prolonged, greater than 6 months. And so that was really exciting. The median duration of response was actually 12.9 months, just to give the actual numbers there. So that zanidatamab IV bispecific agent is quite intriguing in that second line refractory population. And then you also mentioned the other trial that was presented at ASCO this year was tucatinib plus trastuzumab with a biliary tract cohort. It was a smaller cohort under only 30 patients, and all of them were either immunohistochemistry HER2 3+ or amplified. And that showed a response rate of 46%. And so again, two different pieces of new data really reinforcing that HER2 is a viable target and we should be checking for this.
It's interesting about the tucatinib study because that's the same regimen that was used in colon cancer, now approved. But in breast cancer, they add in capecitabine, which is a lot of times is a big headache that people don't like. You get a lot of diarrhea, et cetera. It's kind of interesting the way it was developed. But in all three situations, it seems like you see really effective responses. In terms of the zanidatamab, the bispecific, so I assume, because this is not one of these CD3 immune kind of bispecifics, I guess you don't see cytokine release with this?
I haven't used it, but when I look at the treatment-related adverse events, infusion-related reaction was around 35%, but only 1%, I'm double-checking the numbers right now, only 1% were grade 3 or 4, so they reported as being quite low. There were also a low number of ejection fraction decreases, around almost 4% were grade 3 or higher, but pretty low rates of immune-related reaction, if you consider the 1.3% is quite low.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder how you separate. I mean, I'm sure there are ways to differentiate cytokine release from just an infusion reaction to an antibody. I know they're different, but not sure how easy it is in a trial to separate them. Are you aware of any other tolerability issues with this bispecific?
I think the other adverse event that was called out was diarrhea in around 40% overall and 5% grade 3 or higher. So I think it looks like those were the top adverse events, the diarrhea, the infusion reaction, and the ejection fraction. But most were low grade, and diarrhea was 5% grade 3 or higher.
So you mentioned one of the things that's interesting about these three agents is actually two of them are approved, trastuzumab deruxtecan and tucatinib. Have you or would you use either one of those outside a clinical trial in a patient who was running out of approved options?
I would, and I have. I have used the trastuzumab deruxtecan and also trastuzumab pertuzumab, and I haven't yet used tucatinib, but based on this data, I would consider it, particularly in the occasional patient with brain metastases, and which, again, that's not a common thing at all, but when you see a lot of cholangiocarcinoma, they occasionally show up. But I think more importantly, so yes, I think this, we have enough data from across a variety of mechanisms and of HER2 targeted agents to reassure us that this is a viable target, an active target to hit, and we should be checking for this. And I really hope to see a registrational pathway in future trials ahead.
It's funny you mentioned brain mets because one of our symposia recently, Zev Weinberg from UCLA, was talking about he had a patient with a gastric cancer, HER2 positive. You know, they use first and second line anti-HER therapy there, but the patient had a brain met, and somehow he was able to get tucatinib, and he was able to give it to that patient. So, yeah, I guess you don't see as many brain mets, though, with biliary tract cancers.
Not too often, but they're in the 1% range, yeah.
Anything else that we have? We've talked about a lot of things today in both biliary tract cancers and HCC. I'm sure we left out a lot of great stuff, but anything sort of stick in your mind and anything else you might want to comment on, particularly in terms of things that you're excited about for the future?
Well, I think I'm most excited about just the global picture here of us realizing these are treatable cancers and not a one and done cancer, and opening our eyes that we have options to intervene at multiple places earlier and later in the disease course. And I think that's the most important message for us as oncologists, that we do have options. I think obviously the targeted therapies are very exciting as we refine our understanding of the different subgroups of biliary tract cancers. Likewise, the immune, I'm really hopeful that down the road in the next few years, we'll have more immune subgroups in both biliary and especially HCC to help us pick which regimen to use and to find new, better combinations. So I think we're in an era of big progress because I think the reality is we recognize there's as one of my hepatology colleagues put it, a tsunami on the horizon, or we're just reaching the tsunami of cases that are expected, at least, or projected for hepatobiliary cancers. And so the numbers are going up, and it's really great to have the attention meeting the need now more than in the past.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Kelly, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.